Again. We've got two matters on the agenda. Obviously, members, we're going to start the omnibus finance bills today. I know this is we're in 15, so different seating setup. We're gonna work through our omnibus bills over this next week or so, and it sounds like we might have a couple of division conflicts, so members have to be kind of attuned to that. And tomorrow we're trying to figure out scheduling, because there's a chance that Human Services and Education, K-12 Education, might have to finish in the morning, which creates some concerns. But we'll figure that out as this meeting proceeds. But first on the agenda, we have Senator Kozelka and House File 283. So Mr. Bonner's going to help me out. So let's see, this came out of what, environment? Saxhog. All right, Senator Saxhog's division. So Senator Saxhog moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, then to get in front of us, I think we need to adopt the House File 283. Okay, Mr. Bodden, I knew I wouldn't be able to get through this. So
Mr. Chairman and members, because the House File is in committee, the normal provisions in Rule 45 don't apply, and the committee actually has the language as it appears as passed by the House before it. Assuming that the committee wishes to work from the Senate file, the necessary motion at this point would be to amend House File 283 by deleting everything after the enacting clause and inserting the contents of Senate File 74 as amended by the division report. And then the committee should work from, just for working purposes, work from the language of the bill that you see in Senate File 74 with the division report.
And that's the language we have in front of us. So I knew I'd need some help on that. So as Mr. Bodden has indicated, to adopt the House file with the Senate language on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So then we've got House File 283 in front of us, but working from the language of Senate File 74. So Senator Kozelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other body already has passed this off of their floor. I believe it was 100% in favor of it. But just briefly, this deals with land around Camp Ripley. Camp Ripley currently has a program called the Army Compatible Use Buffer, or ACUB, I'll call it from here on out. It's a program that they've had in place since 2004 that works with the Department of Defense to help have people around Camp Ripley voluntarily enter into usually easements. Sometimes they sell their land with the idea of creating a buffer around Camp Ripley so that as communities continue to develop and encroach Camp Ripley, they don't get upset with what goes on there. Primarily, the ordinances that go off are quite loud. And so, but this program since 2004 has been entered into these leases, and what that's done is to help on the positive side, other than just Camp Ripley, is preserve the working and rural character of the private land. So if they enter into easements, if it was ag, it stays ag. If it was logging, it stays logging. And, so it's been a win-win for everybody in the community. There's everyone that's been involved has been voluntary. But what's changed is the federal government now has a program called the Sentinel Landscape, where it actually this program is being looked at across the country, and it's added different departments. Department of Ag and Department of Interior have also come into this. And so there's a real benefit of us adopting this language early so that we can access more federal dollars. To date, federal dollars from the Department of Defense have been $23 million to help with this, and then there's been $4 million of money from the state through the SARD-SAMs that have been part of this. So I do have two testifiers that I think would be helpful for the committee to hear from, and hopefully we can move forward.
Okay. Normally, if we assume testimony has been taken in division, we wouldn't necessarily need the testimony here, but if you have, if the gentleman would like to testify for a couple of minutes, happy to do so.
In fact, we don't need to do that other than I think Mr. Skoglund has some new information that I think would be worth sharing, and then we'll leave the
Fine.
Rest.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marty Skoglund, the Environmental Program Manager for the Minnesota Army National Guard. And just as it relates to this this proposed legislation, this is being monitored very closely by the Department of Defense. We will be the only state in the nation that will have accomplished this task, and will put Minnesota very much on top and in the forefront of being able to apply for and receive dollars that will be supporting the federal Sentinel Landscapes Program. So we will be postured very perfectly for this. There is a REPI, what they call it, Readiness Environmental Protection Integration Program, which is the DOD program. There will be an application that we will be submitting by May 29th, and it's going to be focusing on Sentinel Landscapes. And so in a conversation just yesterday with our DOD representatives, they're monitoring this closely. They're very excited that we will be first in line for the Sentinel Landscapes consideration.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And so, Sarah Gazelle, how much are the federal dollars anticipated then?
Mr. Chair, so far it's been $23 million, but I believe we're eligible for up to $8 million. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is the 29th May deadline is for an $8 million consideration for Sentinel Landscapes. And not sure we will be successful in securing all $8 million, but we'll have a good shot at getting a good portion of that.
And so as I understand it, in terms of the fiscal note, there's not a state general fund cost. You're simply looking to be able to access the federal money as it becomes available and depending on how much becomes available.
Is that
a fair statement? Questions for Sarah Kozelka or other discussion on the bill? Okay. Anybody want to do anything? I'm sorry, Sarah Kozelka. That's it, I guess.
Move the bill.
All right, well, okay. We got Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Chair, I'm hoping it'll go to the floor and be heard expeditely.
All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that House File 283 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right. Then we have the other bill on the agenda, of course, is the first omnibus bill, Senate File 888. Senator Saxog moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So, why don't we?
Chair, did you just move the division report?
I did.
Oh, good.
And you moved it.
Find my next one. I go through my. Oh my God! That's right. I didn't get that. I didn't get it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 888, I have a small technical amendment that Council has identified that we need, and that we can deal with here if that pleases the chair.
Okay. Do we have
the 821 amendment?
Have we had the amendment distributed? Senator Saxog?
Pardon me? Mr. Chair?
You have the A21 amendment.
A21 amendment. Ms. James is going to speak to it.
Okay, Ms. James.
Mr. Chair and members, the A21 amendment is all items that are clarifying or fixing errors. Lines 1.3 to 1.4, we're deleting an unnecessary phrase. On lines 1.5 and 1.6, this is some clarification to the fees for the Board of Cosmetology to make clear that the total at the top has two components, and it's not, they're not three separate fees, and that'll maybe be clear when we get to the fee section. Line 1.7 clarifies that a particular fee applies for 1 year as opposed to some of the other fees that are 3 year, also for the Board of Cosmetology. Line 1.8 adds a missing preposition. Line 1.9 adds emphasis that a second requirement for certificates of continuing education, it's that it's an additional requirement in, on top of something else that's already there. Line 1.10 deletes a section that is an appropriation that is duplicative of an appropriation that's in Article 1.
All right. So we've got the A21 amendment. Senator Saxog, you're moving the amendment, right?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay. On the Saxog motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Saxog.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'd like to have Mr. Lundeen and Ms. James go through the detailed spreadsheet and the language. But before they begin, just a few quick comments. This bill is approximately $1 billion. Our target was $38 million over the base from the 2013 budget bill. Our division is charged with funding, as you know, the basic core functions of government. And one of the more important aspects of government, and it's only 2.5% of the total budget to do these core functions. So I feel we get a pretty good bang for the buck for what you're seeing here today. And before I turn it over to Mr. Lundeen and Ms. James, I'd like to thank the members of my staff and members of my division for some good work, thoughtful discussion, and putting this package together and sending it to you. With that, I'm going to ask Mr. Lundeen to go over the spreadsheet, and he has one small oral correction that he's going to make out of the chute.
Okay, Mr. Lundeen.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's one number that needs to be changed in the bill, so if we could have an amendment to do that orally. It is on page 12 of the bill, line 12.26. It has to do with the appropriation, the second year for the Minnesota Historical Society. The number should be 22 instead of 29 million. Make it agree with the spreadsheet.
22.955.
22,955,000.
All right. So
I move
we'll,
that, Mr. Chair.
Yep. So we have Mr. Lundeen has made that proposed change, Senator Saxog.
I move that change.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. So Mr. Lundeen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to be going through the detailed tracking spreadsheet. It's titled at the top, 2015 Detailed Tracking. And starting at the top of the spreadsheet, dealing with the appropriations for the legislature. So taking a look at the Senate, in this bill, there is a 3% operating budget increase included. And then there is money included for the Senate office building. In the governor's budget, he included it as a direct appropriation to the Senate from the general fund. But rather, the language before us in Senate File 888 has it as a statutory appropriation, and that is contained in Article 2, Section 2 of the bill. And it breaks out the debt service and then the amount of the appropriation for the operations and maintenance of the new building. And that's a total of $12.9 million for the biennium, which is coming from the general fund. Moving down to the House of Representatives, it's just a base budget there, no increases. And I should point out in the bill, there is a rider. This is a typical rider we've had for a number of years in the budget bill that just appropriates voluntary donations to support the broadcast and print media and appropriates those dollars to the House if they do get any donations. Moving down then is the Legislative Coordinating Commission. First is the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and the auditor came in with a request, which was included in the governor's budget, for some increased staff funding. We have included a portion of that, roughly half of the request, in this bill. In addition, we've included a 1.8% operating budget increase to the OLA. This was the amount that the governor had included for a number of the state agencies and boards as an increase to their budget. I should point out, in the bill, we do have a rider that spells out the amount of the appropriation to the OLA. This was another request from the OLA in years past. We had just kind of included everything together under the LCC appropriation. Then you'll see there's the appropriations to the other offices in the LCC. There are a few changes there. We've also included a 1.8% operating budget increase to the other offices. There is $35,000 a year for the biennium included for the Data Practices Commission. This is to provide some staffing. I believe it's about 0.43 of an FTE to help out with that commission. And then the revisors office had come in with a request for some additional IT services and staff, and we have funded that at half of the requested level that they had, and you'll see that there's a rider in there allowing them to increase their complement by 5 FTEs. The governor had a recommendation for the administrative rules system through the revisor's office. That is not included in this bill. And I should point out, under the legislature, there's also one other rider in there, which is a typical rider we've had in years past, dealing with using money in the base for a legislator's forum, basically meetings with South Dakota, North Dakota, and Manitoba, and that sets aside $10,000 a year. Moving to page 2 of the spreadsheet and the governor's office, the governor had a request for operating adjustment to his budget and then also some additional dollars for some legal and emergency preparedness and constituent work staff. I think that proposal was adding 4.6 FTEs to the governor's office. I should point out there are a couple of riders in the bill under the appropriation. One is a standard rider that we've had in there for years that allows the governor to use up to $19,000 a year for necessary expenses for which there is no other reimbursement. And then there is also language in there requiring reporting to the legislature on the governor's office personnel that have been paid for by other agencies. And then moving down next on line 81, we get to the state auditor. And there were a number of recommendations that were included in the governor's budget. And some funding has been provided for them. One is a staff retention. This is similar to the 1.8% compensation adjustment. There is technology staffing. This is for one FTE in the auditor's office. And then there is also some funding for an infrastructure stress study. And basically, this is establishing a system to collect information on the current state of local government infrastructure in Minnesota. And the original request in the governor's budget was $150,000. We've included $35,000 here. And according to testimony we had last week from the state auditor, this is going to pay for the software costs related to the mapping of this information, and the state auditor has said that she's going to be able to leverage some other dollars through the University of Minnesota and foundations and so forth to get this project up and running. Moving next to the Attorney General, there is no increase in funding there. It's basically the base budget. There is one rider in the bill, which we've had for a number of years, and that's basically transferring $65,000 a year of base funding to the Department of Public Safety for a grant to the Minnesota County Attorneys Association for prosecutor and law enforcement training. Next is moving down to the Secretary of State. The general fund, budget is the base budget. We have included language in the bill. I believe it was from Senator Franson's bill dealing with some filing fees in the business services area. And there is some costs there, but they have statutory authority to pay for out of a special revenue fund for some of the IT costs related to the revised fee structure. There is also one rider under the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chairman?
Here we go.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
To the testifier, could you go back to the Attorney General category? And point me at the line that you were talking about, the fee transfer for training for prosecutors. What line is that?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not. I actually don't have it drawn out on the spreadsheet. It is out of the base funding that they will make this transfer.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Could you then run through that transfer again one more time?
Okay.
Justify.
So it's a $65,000 a year transfer that goes from the Attorney General's budget to the Department of Public Safety. And it is for a grant to the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And so the Attorney General will have an interagency transfer agreement to move those dollars over to DPS, and then DPS will be responsible for the grant to the Attorneys Association.
And Mr.
Senator Newman.
Chair, that fund transfer is for specifically for what training again?
To the testifier, Senator Newman, perhaps I might be able to help unless you can answer this. To the testifier, are you able to?
You can go ahead.
Okay. It is my understanding that the County Attorneys Association for a number of years have been using those proceeds for training around law or anything, new laws that have also been adopted by this body and is done statewide. And so it's a number of different things around new laws as well as existing laws. If there's some new, let's say, some new Supreme Court decision, anything that would help them in their duty in order to prosecute across the state.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm almost done.
Okay. No, but we've
Senator
got
Newman?
Some additional input from Ms. James.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, the rider on page 4, lines 5 through 10.
In the bill.
Describe in the bill. Describe the transfer that you're discussing.
I'll look it
Senator
up later.
Newman?
Again, the in the bill, the site is page and line.
To
the testifier.
Mr. Chair and members, page 4, lines 5 through 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A follow-up? Okay. Thank you. You may continue. Thank you for answering those questions.
Okay. I'll pick back up with the Secretary of State. I was just mentioning the PAVA rider in there. This is a typical rider we've had in the last few budget bills. This is talking about the federal HAVA money that is transferred into a special revenue account, and it basically appropriates the dollars remaining in that fund to the Secretary of State. The expectation is these dollars will be all expended by the end of fiscal year 15. And in talking with the Secretary of State's office, they wanted this rider to remain in there because they thought there could be a small amount of of funds that they have that's dealing with polling place and voting access for persons with disabilities. So they just wanted that there just in case there were a few dollars left at the end of this biennium that they could access next biennium.
Senator Dibble has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Lindy. And how much remains?
I don't recall off the top of my head. I'd have to check on that and get back to you. But there's not much left there.
Oh, Mr. Black.
Senator Dibble, it looks like Mr. Black is coming.
According to Mr. Black, it's about $5,000.
Any follow-up, Senator Dibble? Okay, thank you.
Okay, and then turning to page 4 of the spreadsheet, at the top, the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, the 1.8% operating adjustment is included there. And then we've also included some money for the website redevelopment, and this was dollars that the office was using to redevelop its website in the current biennium, and they're not going to be able to expend all those dollars, so they came in with a request to cancel dollars from fiscal year 15 and reappropriate the dollars so that they would be available in the 16-17 biennium. And the reason we did the cancellation rather than strictly a carry forward is if we cancel the dollars in fiscal year 15, they then will carry forward into fiscal year 16, and we won't have to count it against the target because it'll be part of the carry forward dollars that come forward. And according to the budget rules that we follow, that is a way to do it without it counting against the target. And I could point out there is a rider also in the bill that talks about this appropriation, and also that the office is to report back to the legislature next January on the status of the project. Moving down next to the investment board, there is no change to the base budget there. Next is the Office of Administrative Hearings. And there were a couple of requests that the governor included and that the Senate picked up. The operating adjustment, the 1.8% is included. And there is some money for the data practices hearing costs. And then also an increase to the campaign violations hearing costs. There was $130,000 in the base for the biennium, and this increases it by an additional $100,000 that goes into the base. And there's also appropriation riders for both of those items. Next, moving down to the bottom of the spreadsheet, minute services. There is the operating adjustment for the 1.8%. And then there's also a rider in there dealing with some cash flow assistance from MMD. This is similar to language that we had 2 years ago with the IT consolidation, and to just help them deal with managing the revenue they get and expenditures. It basically has to do with timing as the dollars flow from the agencies to make the payments and so forth. And then there's also a rider that we've had in the bill for a number of years that does not allow Minute to charge fees for public TV access to the state broadcast infrastructure. And it says they can only charge if it's over $400,000 in the biennium. Next is moving down to the Department of Administration. The first change to the budget there is increasing capacity to further the Olmstead plan. This was something that was picked up from the governor's recs, and essentially this is basically to provide assistance and training to state agency staff to help them in complying with the Olmstead plan. And this basically is paying for two FTEs. The next change on the spreadsheet is information policy analysis down on starting on line 283. The operating adjustment you can see there, and then there is also a local government data practices training bill. This was Senate file 853. I guess I neglected to put the Senate file in there. This was a bill from Senator Buzik. And then moving down under materials management, and on lines 293 and 294 are two of the governor's recs that have been picked up in this bill. The first is the equity in public contracting for veterans, minorities, and women, and this is basically funding five FTEs in fiscal year 6 and four FTEs in fiscal year 17 going forward. So there will be four FTEs going into the base, and it's also paying for some IT costs just to provide support to the small businesses. And next we have the targeted group business disparity study. And there's $800,000 one-time dollars there. I should point out there is a rider in there dealing with the targeted group disparity study appropriation that kind of, you know, talks about it. The last time we had one of these studies completed was in 2010, and so the department feels it's time to update this information. And that because the 2010 information will be 7 years old by the time this new study is completed. Moving down through the spreadsheet, you can see for the state archaeologist and the real estate construction services, the 1.8% compensation increases are showing up. Turning to the next page, dealing with the SMART program, the small agency assistance. The operating adjustment was picked up. The additional dollars the governor requested is not in this bill. Then moving down under the system for technology to achieve results, there is additional dollars there for a state agency accommodation reimbursement fund. This language came from Senate File 989, which was a bill of Senator Metzen's. And essentially, it's making a $500,000 a year appropriation out of the general fund. And this is just to assist agencies in making accommodations for employees and applicants with disabilities. So it takes the $500,000 general fund, and there's language in there, transferring it into a accommodation account in the special revenue fund, which is established later in the bill. And the rider here does allow in fiscal year 16 for admin to use 5% of the appropriation to develop policies and procedures to reimburse agencies. And then when we get to the language, Ms. James will talk about, probably go over that admin can use 15% of the biennial appropriations for administrative costs, and that's in statute, so that'll be a permanent. Then moving down the spreadsheet, you can see a number of the programs there, the 1.8% demographer, Office of Grants Management, moving down into the executive support, financial management, and human resources. Then moving down on line 370, we get to the fiscal agent line. And 371 is the in lieu of rent. And this bill makes a change to the appropriation to that in the second year. The in lieu of rent, what that appropriation does is it pays for all of the space in the capital, the lease rent rates to admin to provide services and maintenance and so forth. So a portion of that goes to the Senate, goes to the House. It also covers the Historical Society costs here. It covers the services for the blind, vending, and stores that they have in state agencies. And it also covers the veterans service organizations that are housed over in the veterans organization. So there's a number of entities that this appropriation covers. The reason we've made a reduction in the second year, and there's some language in Article 2, Section 59, that Ms. James will probably touch on further, but it's just requesting the Commissioner of Administration to kind of take a look at this appropriation and do a reevaluation of it, because after the Capitol renovation and the Senate moving into the new office building, and
they wouldn't capitalize.
You know, what is the amount that's really going to be needed for this appropriation, and who is going to all be included under the appropriation? Because as you recall, with the new Senate office building, the operating costs there will be appropriated directly to the Senate for that building across the street. They won't come out of this appropriation. And then I should just point out the next item. This was in the base, but this was covering some of the capital renovation moving costs. And this is a one-time appropriation just for this biennium. Will not continue in the base. Then moving to the next page of the spreadsheet, at the top we get to the public broadcasting grants, and going down public television, there's an increase to the equipment grants, bringing the total for equipment grants to $550 a year. The matching grants is the base level of 1,550 ampers. There was an increase to the community service grants of $200,000 and bringing a total of $592. The equipment grants were increased, bringing the total to $367 a year. Moving down to NPR, that was increased by $250 a year, bringing the total to $560. And when you look in the bill, there are riders for all the public broadcasting grants, which basically set the base, and then the details of the uses of the grants, and requiring the Department of Administration to consider the recs of public broadcasting when giving out these grants. Moving next is the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. At the bottom of the spreadsheet, there's the operating adjustment there. Moving to the next page, Minnesota Management and Budget. We've included a couple of increases there. The 1.8% is included, and the agency had a request for maintaining the enterprise systems. There's an appropriation rider in there, and basically this is some additional money. We funded it at about half of what was the request from the governor, and this is just to maintain and upgrade the systems, such as the accounting system, the HR and payroll, fiscal note system, and so forth. And then there was also the enhanced enterprise level services. We also funded that at half. And basically that appropriation is to provide some uniform guidance to agencies on how to deal with some of the various programs, such as VETS preference, succession planning, accessibility, and issues like that to state agencies. And then moving down the spreadsheet, the next change, which is at the bottom and continues on the next page, which was not included in here, the governor did request authority to carry forward general fund operating budgets for the agencies at a cost of $7.5 million for each biennium, but that is not included in this bill. Moving down to the Department of Revenue, and if we go down to line 541 are the change items. The 1.8% is included there. The department also had a request for maintenance and enhancement of the Minnesota tax system, and that was not fully funded at the governor's level. It was $6 million that was requested. $4 million is in here. And that's to provide some additional staffing resources and dealing with the gen tax, income tax system, the property tax information system, dealing with some increased tax litigation costs and other increases to the operating budget. Then there is also language in the bill dealing with the Stop Cigarette Smugglers. This was from Senate File 1192. And you'll notice a difference from the governor's rec in the appropriation to the Senate. That's because the language changed here as the bill went through the policy committees. And I think once we get, there's a whole article dealing with this. When we get to Ms. James going through the language, we can touch on that further. There is an appropriation rider under the Department of Revenue, and then there's also another rider dealing with the taxpayer assistance grants And this is dealing with dollars in the base. This is an appropriation we had in the last budget bill, so it's $400 a year going to taxpayer assistance to nonprofit organizations. Moving to the next page and getting down to the Lawful Gambling Control Board on line 580, there are a number of changes going on there. The first of which is dealing with a reduction to the appropriation. The revenues in the special revenue fund are not able to support the current appropriation, and so there is a reduction made to bring that in line. The governor had a proposal to increase the funding going into the special revenue fund, and that was making a change to the regulatory fee on charities. And that has not been included in the Senate proposal here. Rather, we've included some general fund dollars to deal with that a problem in the operating budget. And I should point out the one rider there just specifies where the special revenue appropriations come from, which account in the special revenue. Moving down, we have the state lottery. There's the typical rider there that has a cap on the statutory operating expenses. Next is the Minnesota Racing Commission. There are a couple of changes going on there. The first is dealing with some Class C license changes. This is from a bill of Senator Pappas's, Senate File 1663, and also some language that the governor had in his bill. That's in Article 4. We'll get to the language of that when Ms. James goes through the rest of the bill. And so basically there's a couple of riders there stating that the general fund dollars here, the $341,000 that are included, are just for this biennium. And also pointing out that the where the special revenue appropriations are coming from, which account in the special revenue fund. And then there's also some language in there that directs the commission to work with the racing industry to propose some dedicated funding changes to fully support the operations of the commission, and it requires a report back to the governor and the legislature in November of this year. Next, moving down on line 611 is the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. There is an operating adjustment there that the governor included. And then we also have adding to the appropriation $4 million in the first year, dealing with the Mighty Ducks indoor air quality improvements. And there's also language in Article 2, Section 37, kind of dealing with these grants. This came from a bill of Senator Metzen's. Moving to the next page, we get to the Black Minnesotans Council. There's an operating adjustment, the 1.8. The same is true for the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the Asian Pacific Council, and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Next is the Minnesota Historical Society, and we have created or included some additional funds for programs and operating there. The governor did propose the 1.8%. That is picked up here, as well as some additional money for salaries and programs that are one time for this biennium that the Historical Society did request. We did cut down the request a bit here. And there's also some information for the digital preservation and access so that they can continue with that. And then also history education. There's some one-time funding to add to the base level of that of $500,000. And I should point out there are a couple of riders there. There's one just establishing the base for fiscal year 18 and 19 because we did provide some one-time funding that was not going into the base. And then there's a typical rider dealing with not charging for capital tours. And then moving down, we get to the fiscal agents, some of the pass-through grants that go to the International Center, the Air National Guard. I should point out the dollars were not changed there, just the appropriation was broke up between the two fiscal years, just to make it easier for tracking purposes. And the same was done for the Military Museum. at Camp Ripley. There also was a change item. This was from a bill of Senator Gazelka's, funding an archivist position there. And we did provide some one-time funding in the bill 2 years ago. So this is to continue that that archivist work that's going on at the museum there. And then turning to the next page, you will see Farm America. The base appropriation is there. There was a bill of Senator Rosen's that had asked for some additional money for capital improvements. We've included $200,000 one time in fiscal year 16. I think they came in with a list that was close to $450,000 in repairs on Farm America's facilities. Then moving down to the Arts Board, the only change there is the 1.8% compensation increase. There's just some riders there saying that any balances in the first year are available in the second year, and there's some language that was put in the budget bill last year dealing with projects located in Minnesota, just kind of dealing with that the grants, you know, must be spent on projects in Minnesota, and, you know, no more than 10% of the grant can be used for travel outside of the state of Minnesota. Then moving down to the Humanities Center, there was a bill of Senator Torres Reyes providing some additional operating money here. Basically, that additional $99,000 is going to be funding one FTE, various parts of which are going to be working with their education strategy, Veterans Voices programs, and then also providing some grants, stipends for teachers and others to participate, to take part in these particular programs. Then next is the Board of Accountancy, and turning to the next page, and there's language further in the bill that Ms. James will go through, but anyway, the changes, statutory changes that were made, the Board of Accountancy needed some one-time dollars, $10,000, just to notify, send out postcard printing and mailings, and so that's included here. There is no change to the Board of Engineering other than the 1.8%. The Board of Cosmetology, there's the 1.8%, and then there were a couple of bills that we did here in committee. Senate File 737, the language of which and the fee increases and such, which are in Article 2. And basically the appropriation there, the $1.2 million, which is offset by fee revenue that will be going into the general fund, is to fund 13 FTEs that will be dealing with inspections, investigations, processing applications in a timely manner, and just kind of dealing with some of the expedited application processes that they have there. And then we also heard a bill, this was Senator Rest Bill, dealing with the mobile salon regulations, and this bill did originally have a cost, but the Board of Cosmetology said that if we provide the funding for the 13 FTEs, we would not have to provide any additional funding for the mobile salon regulations. And when I get to the revenues, there'll be a small bit of fee revenue coming in. And then the Board of Barbers, it's the 1.8%. Moving down to the contingent accounts, it's basically the base level appropriations. There's just a rider in there explaining how these appropriations can be spent. And then moving down to tort claims, it's the base. It just specifies MMB expends these in the rider and states the statute. Then we have the appropriations for the consolidated legislators and constitutional officers retirement. Those are at the forecasted amounts. Then the next change that comes into an appropriation, which starts at the bottom under para and deals with the MRF account appropriation there. The language dealing with this is contained in the pension bill, which was heard in state and local earlier this week. But the appropriation for that is made in this bill. As you may recall, it was in 2010 when MRF was moved as a separate account into PARA, and there was an unfunded liability there that is paid for. The state picks up a portion of that, and so does the employer, which is chiefly the city of Minneapolis. And at that time, the appropriation was $24 million a year from the state. And so there's been a change to that. PARA has received some updated cost assumptions, which is reducing the total amount needed from the state and from the employer. So the state contribution has been reduced by $8 million a year, as you see there, bringing it down to $16 million. And then moving down to the next line are the appropriations to TRA. These are the additional appropriations. And then the St. Paul Teachers Association, the base level appropriation, aid appropriation going there. And then next, moving down to the Department of Military Affairs, there are some changes going on in the base there that the governor had recommended. There has built up a balance in the enlistment incentives appropriation. This is general fund money that's been given to the agency and that's available until expended. And one of the reasons there has been a balance building up there is the utilization has been lower than was originally projected, and part of this is due to members are required to access the federal tuition assistance before the state assistance. So anyway, this balance has built up. I believe at the end of fiscal year 15, there's projected to be about a $21 million balance that will carry forward. So what is being proposed here is to move some of that around to meet some of the other needs in the agency. And one of the needs is to move some dollars on a permanent basis into the maintenance area of the facilities, and the department has about a maintenance backlog of about $108 million. So we're going to be moving $3 million a year, and this will be permanently in the base, to this appropriation for maintenance. And then there's also a one-time transfer of $10 million that will be happening from the fiscal year 15 balance that I mentioned. And then down on the general support area, there's some dollars that are going to be moved into the to help with the administrative services. And these dollars are basically going to go to assist with replacing some of the vehicles in the fleet that support the military and state emergency operations, and just dealing with some of the increased compensation costs and increased operating costs for the department. The next item on line 860 comes from a bill of Senator Pappas's, Senate File 1176. This is a reimbursement to local governments when public safety employees are called into military service duty. And so we've included $1.5 million a year in there. And there's language which Ms. James will go through, but essentially, if the appropriation isn't enough, the grants are just reduced on a proportional basis. So the 1.5 are the dollars available, and it's not an open appropriation or anything to meet all the needs. And then just going forward on the spreadsheet to page 15, you can just see the base movement out of the enlistment incentives there. Next, moving down to the Department of Veterans Affairs, there are a few items there, the first of which is an appropriation of $44,000 to the Department of Veterans Affairs. And if you look at the base rider there, what that does is it appropriates the money to Vets Affairs, but it is then transferred to the Department of Ed. And this relates back to, if you recall, in the supplemental budget bill last year, there was language dealing with the military expedited and temporary licensing with a number of the licensing boards. And they were given some money for rulemaking to implement this. Well, the Board of Teaching was not able to get their rulemaking done or won't be able to have it completed by the end of this biennium. So they then requested if we could carry forward these dollars. And so this has been treated much in the way when I talked about the appropriation to the Campaign Finance Board, where we canceled it in fiscal year 15. And the money flows through as a carry forward into 16, and we have then reappropriated those dollars. And then moving down, you'll see a number of the programs and services. We do have riders for some of these. There was no increase to them. The Gold Star program, that's base level funding. The Minnesota Assistance Council for Vets, MACV, that's dealing with homeless vets and that. That has the rider that we had in there 2 years ago that does require recipients to have resided in Minnesota for at least 30 days prior to be assisted through these grants. There is also another rider in there dealing with the GI Bill, administrative costs, and part of those, $100,000 of that is transferred to the Office of Higher Ed because they do with the GI Bill the administration of it. Then moving down to the claims and outreach, we also have riders in there dealing with the county veteran services grants. They are funded at base level, the Honor Guard funding, which is funded at base level, and then also the appropriations of $353,000, which is the base level that goes to the various veteran service organizations, and they're listed in the rider. Then turning to the next page, I've just shown on there the Support Our Troops. This is a statutory appropriation, but there are some changes to the uses of that that Ms. James will touch on when we get into the language. Then we move down to the Veterans Health Care on line 963, and this is basically dealing with the funding for the various vets' homes around the state. And the governor did include some additional funding there. In his original budget recommendations, there was a 5% adjustment compensation increase, which the Senate did pick up. Then he came out at the beginning of this week with a supplemental adjustment there of about almost $10.8 million for the biennium. And the reason this was come out with, the agency would like to keep its staffing levels at its fiscal year 15 levels. And they're not able to do that with the governor's original recommendation. I should point out the general fund appropriations that we make for the vets' homes, and there's a rider in there that kind of details this, but once the agency gets the general fund appropriation, they then put it into a special revenue account, and the federal dollars that come in and any of the dollars from the clients in the homes go into this special revenue account, which then pays for the costs of the veterans' homes. And so over the past several years, they've built up quite a balance in that fund, and so they've been spending down that balance and paying some of the staffing costs out of that. But it appears in the 16-17 biennium, most of that balance is going to be spent down, so they're going to be, you know, faced with dealing with less staffing, less dollars available for staffing. So either they're going to have to cut staffing or get an additional general fund appropriation, which is what the governor has provided there. And then the next item down there, there is also a rider on this, is some repair and betterment funding of $500,000 a year for the homes that goes into the base. And then also there is language in the bill dealing with the cost of care personal needs allowance. This is Senate File 131, a bill of Senator Stevens that we heard in the division and then included the language in here. And then there is also one other rider in the bill that was also there 2 years ago, which just directs the department to seek opportunities to maximize federal reimbursements of Medicare-eligible expenses and then to annually report this to MMP. And then moving down to the bottom of the spreadsheet, you can see the direct appropriation totals by fund. And if we turn over to the next sheet, I'll go down to starting at line 1014 is dealing with some of the revenues and transfers in here that impact the general fund. The first of which is dealing with the Senate office building parking reimbursement. And there's some language in Article 2, Section 57 of the bill. But the way the appropriation is structured is there will be an appropriation out of the general fund to cover the debt service for the new building and for the parking ramp associated with the new building. But as you recall, with parking facilities here, they are user financed. revenue bonds that pay for them. So basically, this is capturing the fee revenue that'll come in from the parking spots that are leased out, and then just transfers this to the general fund, kind of as an offset to the appropriation to the Senate. And then moving down to Secretary of State, this is dealing with some of the fee changes that are going on in Article 2, which Ms. James will touch on this more, but this came from Senate File 1476, a bill of Senator Franzen's, and it's kind of making some changes to the federal tax liens filing fees, foreign corporation fees, kind of making some changes to a flat fee in it. Overall, it doesn't really change the amount of money coming in. There'll be slightly less coming in, so it was almost a revenue-neutral proposal other than, you know, the small $3,000 difference. Then moving down to the revenue department, we have the compliance revenue and the fines and fees revenue that will be coming in from the cigarette smugglers language that's contained in the bill. Then moving down to the cosmetology, these are the license fees that I was talking about. The revenue from these fees come in as a non-dedicated receipt to the general fund, so they're reflected here to offset the appropriation. And then I did mention there would be some fee revenue coming in from the mobile salon regulations, and that won't be coming in until the next biennium because of the effective date in the bill of July 1st, 2017 for those provisions. Then the non-general fund revenues are shown here. I mentioned under the Gambling Control Board, the regulatory fee increase was not included. And then the Racing Commission kind of fee changes that they're proposing there, and we'll be putting together through the rulemaking process are shown there. And so basically going down the spreadsheet, I guess I'll just point out on line 1051, the net general fund spending in this bill is just slightly over $1 billion. And it's again less than what the governor had requested. It's almost $38 million more than the base level funding, and you can see down there taking a look at what the target was for this committee, just slightly over 38, and there's $148,000 on the bottom line. And same as we go forward looking at the tails, we had a target of $48 million there, and spent almost $38 million in the tails, so there is about $10 million in the tails unspent. So that essentially is the spreadsheet. If there are any questions, if not, Ms. James can run through the language and the other articles.
Do we have questions for Mr. Lundeen, Senator Newman?
Mr. Chair, not for Mr. Lundeen, but for Mr. Nauman, if I may, two basic questions, Mr. Nauman. In this bill and in others, I am routinely seeing a 1.8% increase. Can you give me any indication as to what does that represent? I mean, is that inflation, cost of adjustment? Is it an actual increase in funding? Where's that number coming from?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, in the governor's recommendation, in his budget recommendation, he included a 1.8% increase to operating budgets as part of his recommendation, and the Senate has chosen in I believe most occasions to reflect a corresponding increase in the Senate proposals. So that's the origination of that number. It does not necessarily mean that salaries will increase by 1.8%. I think that's commonly what is thought about, but it doesn't. There isn't a requirement that the salaries for state employees change by that amount. It's just an increase in the overall operating budget by that amount.
And Senator Newman, just so there's no not confusion, but You're going to see this, and I think you're aware that from the division you're on, you'll see this in the other bills as well relative to the agency budgets. There are a couple of exceptions to that in other bills, but the request for the 1.8 will be reflected in all the omnibus bills relative to the state agencies. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, I'm aware of it, and that's why I'm asking Mr. Nauman the question, because we're going to see this over and over. I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, what is the real or true effect of 1.8%. I realize it's in the governor's recommendation and all of that, but what does it, you know, in terms of cost of living or inflation or however else you want to phrase it, what does it really mean to us?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, I can just, it might be helpful to, with the knowledge that the forecast has just a little bit more than 2% built into the, inflation is booked at, if you were to consider what the inflationary effect on the overall budget is, the forecast gives us a inflationary calculation that's a little bit over 2% for the 2 years of fiscal 16 and 17. So this is a little bit lower than that number, but inflation can be measured a variety of different ways, and I believe the CPI, which is used for the purposes of calculating the inflationary effect on the forecast, is just one measure of that.
And Senator Newman, if I could just follow up, that if you do look at the budget forecast book, and not so much the smaller information we get, but if you look at the larger book, they'll discuss inflation at a national level. And as Mr. Nauman's pointed out, I think the reflection is something like a 2%. And in the meetings of the Council of Economic Advisors, where Senator Fischbach and I are invited to listen, not to participate, in the discussions they had, there was agreement on the part of the economists advising the state economists, the promulgation of the forecast, that was felt a realistic inflation figure. So I think what the governor did with his budget is to err on the side of caution and go a little bit lower than what has been reflected with the CPI. That was my sense from listening to the economists.
And that's helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman. I'm just trying to get a handle on what that figure might mean. And I've got one more basic question.
Sure.
For Mr. Nauman. We consistently are seeing a number that is the base number. Mr. Nauman, is the base number the same number as current spending, or is there a difference? I realize these are pretty basic questions, but I'm just trying to figure this out.
No, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, it may be, it may not be, and I'm not trying to be evasive about that, but there are a number of rules that govern how the base is calculated. In this particular budget area, the rule that tends to predominate is that the base for the prior, the last spending, or the last appropriation in fiscal 15 tends to be carried forward under the budget rules for fiscal year 16 and 17, and is assumed to be the old tail then becomes the number that we begin with for setting the base. So in a direct appropriation that had, say, a $5 million appropriation level in fiscal 15, that number is then carried forward into 16 and 17. Unless there is a forecasted adjustment or other guidance in a rider for the prior year that would inform it to be a different number. That's typically the general rule. We'll see in some of the other budgets in human services and K-12 being the notable examples, that when those programs often have forecasted amounts based on utilization rates or pupil counts, et cetera. And in that case, the forecast will not be the number from the previous year, but is informed by the anticipated pupil counts or other factors that govern the spending in those areas.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I understand Mr. Nauman correctly, the base might be the prior spending level, but it might not be. And so if that is the case, then, Mr. Nauman, as we're looking at these these sheets, these ledgers, how can we tell whether there is an actual increase or decrease in the prior spending?
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, I'm only parsing your words slightly because you said spending and I emphasized appropriation. So the prior appropriation informs what the base level will be. That doesn't necessarily mean, because there are certain laws that allow agencies to carry forward unspent money in, say, fiscal 14 into fiscal 15, that wouldn't set a higher base level if that action was taken. How you know is that the number one, it's published in the fund balance, which then gets reflected in the legislative spreadsheet tracking. We go through a whole process of making sure that the spreadsheets actually reflect the base numbers so that you have those in front of you when you're considering changes to them. And I can let Mr. Lundin point those out on his tracking to help you see where what the base levels are. And it might be actually a useful question as all these budgets come forth to ask fiscal staff to point those numbers out to you. We have a definition of what the base is in statute that deals with all these peculiarities that we've talked about, but it would be helpful probably for your consideration to ask fiscal staff to show you where the base is on their tracking, because each spreadsheet's a little bit different and deals with the vagaries of each particular budget area.
Thank you, Mr. Norman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So other questions for Mr. Lundin? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Ms. James, on the language in the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill, which before you is a division report, there are five articles. The first article is the appropriation article, and Mr. Lundin has described the riders in that as he described the spreadsheet. So I'll begin with Article 2, which begins on page 21. Section 1 that begins on line 21.10 permits the Legislative Coordinating Commission to appoint staff for the Legislative Data Commission if funding is available. Section 2 that begins on line 14 of page 21 establishes a statutory appropriation to the Senate to make rent payments on the new Senate office building and also to make operations and maintenance costs to pay operations and maintenance costs for the building. This section also requires the Commissioner of Administration to report annually to the legislature on the uses of the appropriation for the operations and maintenance money. There is also another provision in here that says that if the Commissioner of Administration breaches their obligations to the Senate may contract with other entities for the services of operations and maintenance. Turning to Section 3 on page 22, beginning at line 5, Section 3 allows agencies to make advance payments for information technology hosting services. This will allow them to use or to contract for cloud-based hosting services. Section 4 begins on line 18. This is the accommodation reimbursement program that Mr. Lundin mentioned. This is from Senator Metzen's bill, Senate File 989, as amended in division. The program is set up to be an account that is administered by the Department of Administration. Agencies are required by law to make reasonable accommodations for employees who need them. And this allows those agencies to then apply for reimbursement of those costs of providing accommodations. It doesn't apply to every accommodation. There's a on lines 23 through 27 some caveats for the kinds of reasonable accommodations that are covered by this fund, and they're sort of designed to be more substantial so that the account is not tapped with a lot of small transactions. And as Mr. Lundin mentioned, on lines 23.5 and 23.6, the Commissioner of Administration is permitted to use 15%, up to 15% of the biennial appropriation to administer this program. Line 12, there's a requirement for a report by the Commissioner of Administration each year on the use of this fund. Sections 5 and 6, Section 5 begins on page 23 at line 28. This is a provision from Senator Stump's bill, Senate File 1676. Sections 5 and Section 6 exempt certain kinds of contracts from the contracting provisions in 16B.97 and 16B.98. And the reason that MMB and administration have asked for this change is that these provisions are largely duplicative of obligations or constraints around contracting in sections in Chapter 16C. Page 24, Section 7, also from Senator Stump's bill, Senate File 1676, it eliminates a requirement that a grant recipient has to get prior approval for an expense in order to be reimbursed by MMB from the general obligation bond program.
Never mind.
Section 8 begins on line 20. It makes some changes to the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, and this is also from Senator Stump's bill, Senate File 1676. The changes that are made are that there's an expansion of the types of project financing that may be used to pay for guaranteed energy savings projects. This includes the new financing that are permitted can be a mix of leasing and bonding. It eliminates the specification that utility cost savings measures become the sole property of the state after the final obligated payment is made. It changes the calculation that sets the threshold that determines whether the commissioner is authorized to enter into an agreement for the utility cost savings measures. It replaces the commissioner's authority to enter into a lease purchase agreement with the authority to enter into project financing for implementing utility cost savings measures. And lastly, it eliminates a restriction that the implementation costs of the utility cost savings measures are not permitted to exceed the amount to be saved in utility and operation and maintenance costs over the term of the lease purchase agreement. Section 9 is on page 27, beginning at line 10. This is from the governor's recommendations in Senate File 888. It directs the Commissioner of Administration to use the size standard that is in federal regulations to certify small businesses for purposes of contracting preferences in state contracting for procurement and construction contracts. Section 10 on page 27, beginning at line 20, is also from the governor's recommendations. This requires organizations that receive contracts for state-funded capital improvements to promote the use of targeted business groups. And targeted business groups are women, minority, and veteran-owned businesses. Section 11 begins at the bottom of page 27, line 31. And going on to page 32, it provides an automatic process to be certified as a small business if you are certified under federal regulations. And it also permits the Commissioner of Administration to use expedited rulemaking to implement the certification program. Section 12 begins on page 28 at line 31. This is a provision from Senator Johnson's bill, Senate File 737. This is a proposal from the Board of Cosmetology, and there are several sections following here that are part of that bill. This section 12 adds infection control and the use of implements to the reasons that the practice of cosmetology is regulated. Section 13 on page 29 is a definition of a manager, and there will be more definitions for the Board of Cosmetology in sections 15 through 19. These are also part of Senator Johnson's bill, Senate File 737 from the Board of Cosmetology's cosmetologist examiners. It adds new definitions in the chapter for the Board of Cosmetology examiners for professions that are required to be licensed. Section 14 is the first of three sections that are from Senator Ress's mobile salon bill, Senate File 839. Current statutes do not prohibit mobile salons, but they authorize the Board of Cosmetologist examiners to establish rules about salons. And at the moment, those rules are such that there isn't any way for a mobile salon to be able to comply. And so, as a result, mobile salons are not permitted. So what Senator Ress's bill does is permits them by establishing a definition of mobile salon, and then later we'll see directing the Board of Cosmetologist examiners to establish rules around mobile salons. As I mentioned, sections 15 through 19 are definitions from Senator Johnson's bill for the Board of Cosmetologist examiners. Section 20 modifies the board's authority for licensing employees. It adds inspections and complaint investigations to the duties that the board is allowed to hire staff to do, and it also removes a training requirement for the board's staff. Section 21, beginning on line 21 of page 30, modifies fees for the practices that the Board of Cosmetology Examiners regulates. In some cases, it changes the fees themselves, and it also adds certain categories of things that are new to the list of fees. Section 22 begins on page 32, line 22, and sections 22 and 23, taken together, give the board some extra time to issue a license when an application meets certain conditions. Currently, under current law, they're required to either approve or deny a license within 15 working days, but these two sections together allow the board to take a little additional time when the conditions at the top of page 33 are met, when the applicant is the subject of a complaint investigation, or the applicant has pending disciplinary actions before the board, or the board will comply, or the application contains discrepancies. In those circumstances, the board is then allowed to follow a timeline that's set elsewhere in statute in 15.92, and that is a time period of about 60 days with some options for extra time if conditions are met. Section 24 and 25 are analogous to sections 22 and 23. Section 24 requires the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners to act on temporary military or expedited licenses within 5 days. And then Section 25 gives them extra time if those conditions that I described, like the application contains discrepancies, are met. Section 26, beginning on line 22 of page 33, requires a license to practice as an advanced practice esthetician. And that is a term that is defined in Section 15. And I just will point out that it doesn't cover tattooing. It looks maybe like it would if you don't know these terms. But tattooing is covered by the Board of Health, is governed by the Board of Health in another chapter. Section 27 gives the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners authority to establish rules related to safety of practitioners and customers. Current law only gives them the authority to rule make issues of health. Section 28, at the top of page 34, is a conforming amendment. It removes a fee that it puts into the fee section of the bill, of the statute. Section 29, beginning at line 6, adds one additional continuing education course. That is a four-hour course on any of a few specific topics to the continuing education requirements for the professions regulated by the board. It also prohibits marketing or sale of products during a continuing education course. And the section limits the kind of board-recognized professional organizations that are allowed to offer continuing education courses for credit. It has to be a Minnesota nonprofit corporation. And then also other entities like schools are in current law and still allowed to offer continuing education courses. This section also shortens the period from 3 years to 1 year that a continuing education provider is authorized by the board to be a continuing education provider. Section 30 on page 36, line 9, sort of restates the licensing requirement to practice cosmetology for compensation, and it eliminates an exemption that was in current law for licensing of anesthesiologists in the office of a licensed physician. Section 31 begins on line 18. It's a housekeeping amendment. There was a sentence that had no verb and therefore no meaning, and so that is removed. Page 37, section 32, is the second of the provisions for Senator Rest's mobile salon bill. This establishes in statute a couple of requirements for mobile salons, one, that it has a permanent business address, and two, that it notify the board of its locations and schedule of operation. Section 33 begins on page 37 at line 9 It requires an applicant for a cosmetology school license to employ a designated manager who has a cosmetology salon manager license. Section 34 on page 38, line 9, modifies the prohibition on discrimination in schools, cosmetology schools. It makes it conform to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The result of this is that it adds several categories of protected classes, religion, marital status, disability, age, and status with respect to public assistance, and it removes the category of citizenship. Section 35 is Senator Senjum's bill, Senate file 1984, and this extends the life of the Minnesota River Parkway Commission until 2020. Section 36, beginning on line 16 on page 38, is a housekeeping provision. It is reflecting a change that was made in law in 2009 that reflects that the Office of Administrative Hearings is paid from the general fund instead of from the elections campaign fund, and this applies to costs associated with hearing complaints related to statewide ballot questions or on elections for statewide office or legislative offices. Section 37 that begins on page 38, line 26, is Senator Metzen's Mighty Ducks bill. The new language is on page 40, beginning at line 12, or in the paragraph that begins at line 12. And this sets some caps for the air quality grants. The air quality renovations are capped at $200,000. And then a rehabilitation or renovation grant to replace the R22 refrigerant in an indirect cooling system is capped at $50,000. And the cap for replacing the R22 refrigerant in a direct cooling system is $400,000. Section 38 through 43 and 55 are from Senator Franson's bill, Senate file 1476. And these are proposals from the Secretary of State's office. Section 38 eliminates an extra fee that they used to charge when a lien was filed with more than two debtors listed on it. Section 39 on page 41, line 3, modifies the filing requirements for a foreign corporation whose certificate of authority to do business in the state is revoked or canceled, and it raises the fee for reinstatement. Section 40, beginning at line 26, restates the due date for the filing of an annual report for a public benefit corporation. Section 41 is a conforming change to reflect that change of report date in the previous section. Section 42, which is begins at page 42 at line 9, requires a corporation to amend its articles of incorporation after it loses its status as a public benefit corporation. Section 43, which begins on line 21, provides that a corporation expires 30 days after its status as a public benefit corporation is terminated or revoked if it fails to change its corporation name to reflect the changed status. Sections 44 through 54 are from Senator Rest Bill, Senate File 802, and this is a proposal from the Board of Accountancy. Section 44, that begins on page 42, line 27, modifies the definition of a test, the word test, A-T-T-E-S-T, to align with model language in the Uniform Accountancy Act. Section 45 that begins on line 7 of page 43 modifies the definition of peer review to include CPA firms and individuals. Section 46 that begins on line 13 of page 43 eliminates unnecessary words in the definition of principal place of business. Section 47 modifies the definition of report to align the language for changes made to section 44. Section 48 that begins at the bottom of page 43 adds the Commonwealth of North Mariana Islands to the list of U.S. territories. Section 49 is a technical correction. Section 50 that begins on line 19 of page 44 authorizes the Board of Accountancy to adopt rules that reflect recognized standards for attesting. Section 55 is begins on page 45, line 27, adds certain attesting activities to the list of those that may be permitted by to be practiced by an out-of-state firm. Section 52 that begins on page 46 at line 24 eliminates the use of an undefined phrase. Section 53 that begins on page 47 at line 21 raises the maximum fine from $2,000 to $5,000 that the Board of Accountancy is authorized to impose for a violation of law. Senator Saxhog notes that we are maybe crunched for time. If the committee would like, I will skip ahead to the end of the Board of Accountancy provisions. Okay. Section takes us to section 56. Section 56, which is on page 52, this is a change to old laws for the Office of Minute Services from 2013. It just is technical corrections and slightly extends their deadline for repaying the funds that are part of their cash flow. Section 57 is the treatment for the parking fees for the Senate building that Mr. Lundeen mentioned earlier. Section 58 is the capital room numbers. This is a provision that requires the Commissioner of Administration to keep the room numbers the same in the capital after renovation as they were before renovation for the rooms that have the same dimensions and location of the current rooms. Section 59 is an in lieu of rent evaluation, and Mr. Lundeen mentioned this. This requires the Department of Administration to provide a report to the legislature by January 15th of 2017 that will detail certain items about how the in lieu of rent payment is calculated. Section 60 is on page 54, line beginning at line 60. These are rulemaking provisions for the Board of Cosmetology related to the earlier provisions in the bill. Section 61 begins at line 22, and this requires that if an agency needs ongoing information technology services as a result of the appropriations in this bill, they are required to enter into an agreement with Minute. 62 is a revisor instruction, and 63 eliminates the definition of licensed practice. Article 3 is the Military and Veterans Affairs article. Section 1 is from Senator Pappas's bill, Senate File 1176. This requires the Adjutant General of the Department of Military Affairs to establish a grant program to pay grants to local units of government to reimburse them for paying the salary and benefits to public safety employees who are on authorized leave. Section 2 expands the permitted uses of the Support Our Troops account so that grants may be given to certain nonprofits and foundations. Section 3 requires an annual report of the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs about the use of the Support Our Troops account. This is already required of the Adjutant General, so this makes the requirement. Section 4 on page 56, line 6, is another part of Senator Pappas's bill, Senate File 1176, that requires the Adjutant General to make grants and sets up an application process and deadline for reimbursement, again, of the salaries and benefits of employees, public safety employees who have military duty. The size of the grants is scaled proportionally to the appropriation. Section 5 at the top of page 57 extends the, this is from the governor's supplemental recommendations, it extends a death gratuity payment to the family of any officer or enlisted member of the armed forces, not just to those who can demonstrate hardship as the law currently reads. It also changes the source of these funds from the an appropriation to the maintenance fund from the an appropriation from the emergency service. Section 6 from the Governor's Supplemental is a requirement that the Adjutant General establish a program to provide bonuses to members of the National Guard who complete training in areas that the Adjutant General identifies. Section 7 and 10, beginning on page 58, one are from Senator Saxe's bill, Senate File 427. It permits the Board of Trustees for the Bic Island Veterans Camp to remove a board member or a trustee with the majority vote of the trustees, and it also provides for filling a trustee vacancy. Sections 8 and 9 are from Senator Stevens' bill, Senate File 131. They authorize the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to establish a method of calculating a maintenance charge for domiciliary residents, and it also sets an amount for a personal needs allowance and indexes that to half of the consumer price index. Section 9 on page 59, beginning at line 17, precludes, this is also from Senator Stevens' bill, Senate File 131, and precludes lowering the personal needs allowance for a resident when the resident is behind on maintenance owed. Section 10, again, Senator Saxe's bill, Senate File 427, it repeals provisions relating to the creation and duties of the Board of Governors for the Big Island Veterans Camp. Page 60. The section 1 eliminates the requirement that racing begin by the May, and also eliminates the requirement that the season have a certain number of weeks. Section 2, 4, 5, and 6 are all new definitions that are used in this bill. Oh, and I should note that this is Senator Pappas's bill. All of this article is Senator Pappas's bill, Senate File 1663, I think. Yes, 1663. And portions of this are responsive to an issue that arose with running aces and their calculation of purses. The issue was detailed in a legislative auditor report in the middle of 2014. And so you'll see a change here to address that. Section 7 changes the qualifications for the director of the Racing Commission to eliminate the requirement for that the director have experience in administration and regulation of paramutual racing. Section 8 adds some powers to the Racing Commission, allowing them to subpoena the attendance of witnesses and some other evidence. Section 9 changes certain conditions for getting a Class C racing license. Class C racing licenses go to people like horse owners, jockeys and drivers, exercise riders, grooms, trainers, paramutual personnel, and security officers, and they have to attest to a certain lack of, or they have to tell about any violations of law or rule related to horse racing, paramutual betting, or any other forms of gambling. Section 10, that begins on page 62 at line 30, permits the commission to issue licenses that are good for up to 3 years. Section 11, that begins on page 65 at line 5, adds grounds for the commission to revoke a Class C license, permits appeal of a Class C license revocation to the commission. It extends the timeline for a hearing and for issuance of a report by the ALJ in a contested case. Section 12 removes a cap on the annual fee for a Class C license. The language is actually on the top of page 64. Section 13, that begins on line 4, is a substantial revision to the way that purse contributions are calculated. This provides for a licensee to pay to apply to purses 8.4% of the handle for live races. And for simulcast races, 37% of takeout after certain deductions. It requires the licensee to pay 5.5% to the Breeders' Fund and an amount agreed to for the horse person's organization. It also has a manner of dealing with a situation where the race at the track is a mixed meet, so there are multiple breeds, but money is coming in from the simulcasting and be divided amongst the breed groups. Section 14, page 66 at line 21, permits simulcasting to be conducted on a commingled pool basis or, with the approval of the commission, on a separate pool basis. Section 15 applies to card club revenue at a racetrack. It permits the licensee and horse person's organization to agree on amount of card club revenue to be used to improve the horse racing industry. As long as that amount is greater than that is specified in this section. Section 16 changes the basis for the tax that the licensee pays to the commission. Right now, licensee pays a tax of 1% of the total amount bet on each racing day, but with this change, the licensee will pay a tax of 1% on the handle for live races conducted at a Class A facility. Provides that all money generated by all simulcasts is distributed to certain programs certain incentives for the horse breeding industry. Section 18 increases the maximum fine that the commission can authorize a steward to impose on licensees for a 19 on page 70 at line 5 raises the threshold for a fine to initiate a contested case hearing from $2,000 to $5,000. It permits the commission to keep fines to cover attorney's fees in contested cases that it wins. Under current law, that money would go into the general fund. Section 20 on page 70, beginning at line 21, gives the commission rulemaking authority relating to wired and wireless communications and also procedures for sampling and testing horses for banned substances and practices. Section 21 gives a certain exemption to the criminal offender rehabilitation chapter, and that has limits on how a person's criminal background, when it can be looked into and how it can be used, and so this gives an exemption for the racing commission. Section 22 is a revisor's instruction, and Section 23, on page 72, is a repeal of an unused definition. Article 5 is a revenue article, and this is the cigarette contraband overhaul of how this is regulated. And I'm happy to go through this section by section, but if you are short on time, I don't need to.
Okay, questions for Ms. James on anything but the last section?
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I had a couple questions here relating primarily to the Senate office building parking ramp, I guess, and then some questions about the cosmetology board. In dealing with this bill in committee for the Senate office ramp, did the dollar amount or the monthly fee for the users come out in testimony at all for the parking ramp? So what will, if a senator chooses to move in there, what will be the cost for parking for the senators or for the staff that will use that parking ramp?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we probably should have administration come up here and give you the exact number.
Okay.
Okay, would that be Mr. Wozlowski here? Or? I thought we had. Oh, there. Okay. Mr. Wozlowski.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wozlowski. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. Senator, there will be, they're currently going through and reviewing rates, parking rates for the upcoming biennium, and there will be an adjustment again over the summer that will be, once approved, distributed out, that will reflect the debt service for parking, to cover the debt service on parking.
So Mr. Chair, you know, at this point, what I've heard in passing, I guess, is that it's going to be in the neighborhood of $160, $170 a month. Is that accurate or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's a good ballpark number to you.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, I don't know if you have a concern about that. I mean, I live just two blocks south of the Capitol here, and I frequently see monthly parking rates in ramps that are advertised in big yellow signs that are $85 or $95 a month for parking. Are you concerned that price is too exorbitant for our staff and for the senators? Or?
Well, I'd Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I would again let Senator Mr. Walewski take care of this, but I guess I would say that this is indoor parking. It is premium parking, and nobody is obligated to park there. So those are, the two points I'd make, and then if you have anything else.
Mr. Chair, Senator, obviously it's certainly an impact for all the folks that are using parking on the campus. The one thing we are, comparing to are downtown St. Paul rates, and so as Chair was mentioning, there's different rates on the campus depending on the type of facility. In this case, it's a garage facility that's below grade, so it does have a higher rate than a surface parking lot, for example. So compared to downtown St. Paul rates, we're still on the campus. Overall, it's going to be a comparable market rate. So it really does depend on which parking facility you are comparing to. There's other parking facilities that are close by that are at lower costs. So, but overall, compared to downtown parking facilities, the rates are relative still on the campus.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog. So it's safe to assume if those parking spots don't fill up, then the parking fee for those that choose to use it will continue to rise, or will rise to pay for the ramp?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you're correct. How the parking rates work on the campus is you take the overall costs between debt service and operating costs, and those are allocated to the various parking facilities, so you cover the costs. So if there's obviously, we're going to look to work with the Senate. If there is a parking available, we'll certainly want to try to make sure that we're utilizing the ramp, all the ramps on the campus as best we can to help keep costs down.
So Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, so will the parking fees related to other facilities, will that be used to offset the cost of this ramp, or is each ramp looked at separately and the users and the amount of spaces that are actually rented as far as demand in each parking area?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the costs are spread across it's not individualized by parking ramp. It is spread across the campus, so it's by parking facility type. So a parking garage has one rate, a parking ramp has another rate, and a parking lot, a surface lot, has a separate rate. So it is that the costs are allocated across the campus versus on an individual ramp basis. I will note that in the House State Government Finance Bill, there is language to that would have the ramp associated with the Senate building be paid strictly by users in the Senate ramp, of the Senate ramp, and that obviously would be a very expensive impact on parking rates for that facility if that was enacted into law.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, I guess from my perspective, I was not aware of that, and it would seem much more fair a way to handle that situation instead of asking, somebody that chooses to be more economically conscious and park in the surface lot that's probably paid for already and use those dollars to help supplement or reduce the cost in a below-grade heated premium parking spot. Does not seem to be fair, from my perspective, if I heard you correctly.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would say, though, that the parkers on the campus, for example, the new ramp next to the transportation building, all the parkers on the campus are helping pay for that facility, as when the Anderson building, parking associated with that building, same thing with the 14th Street ramp. So the parkers on the campus, including the surface lot, that's been the policy that the costs are allocated across all the parking facilities. So it's that policy is not applicable just to this ramp. It's
All the parkers on the campus have been paying those costs all along.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, I just did some quick math here. I mean, based on the low end, which would be $160 a month, which I guess the next question I should clarify is that year-round?
Mr. Chair, Senator, correct.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, if that is year-round, that's what I was assuming when I did the math as well. You're approaching between $1,900 and $2,000 a year for the privilege of parking in that premium parking ramp, which in my head, I guess if you do that, that's approaching, you know, $20 of a per diem that the senator receives year-round. And then on a daily basis, you know, per the per diem just during session, at based on five days a week. And then, of course, our staff does not get that. Senator Saxog, I would have grave concern in regards to the cost of that parking ramp compared to other things that are available, particularly if it doesn't fill up and people don't want to use it at the price tag of almost nearly $2,000 a year for a part-time legislature, quite frankly. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, I guess I think you're going to continue to hear more about that issue in particular. But as a summary statement, I guess my next question, Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog focuses around the cosmetology area there. On page 31, they're kind of starting at line 31.18, and for the next few lines, there appears that all those are new license fees. It says $4,000 for initial school license, $3,000 for each initial license, $1,000 for the application fee. And on down the line, are those all new licenses for this industry right now?
We have somebody from, come on up. Ms. Stoss, Mr. Chair, we'll answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Gina Stoss, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. The fees are not new fees. They're changed fees. We tried to reorder the fee schedule because it's very long and very lengthy, and so in a part of modifying the fees as well as cleaning it up, the line items got changed. And a part of the technical amendment earlier today, I believe, what they're going to do, if you look like specifically at line 31.8, it's a $4,000 initial school license divided by $3,000 for the initial and $1,000. So it's not $4,000 plus $3,000 plus $1,000. Several years ago, the legislature, about 4 years ago, had added a application fee in order to process and support the 15 business day state law. So the fees are not new. Up to line, basically, the at the start of 3.25 through 3.23 are just 3.22 are just changed fees and reordered fees. We do have a couple new voluntary fees that start on line 32.18 through 32.21. So those are new fees, but those are not required fees for an individual to pay. That's if they would like to expedite their license or would like to be a continuing ed provider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saxog or the testifier, these all appear to be very significant in my view. In fact, I think the worst one I see almost doubles or increases by 100%. Most all of them are significant is the best way to describe them. Like I said, the most egregious I see is 100% or basically doubling in a number of these fees. So what are you telling the industry right now? What percent their cost of doing business in Minnesota will be if all these fees go into effect total?
Mr. Chair and members, the first thing to understand is that the board is on a unique 3-year license fee. which is somewhat abnormal in the professional regulations. So the fees that are changing are a three-year license fee. So when we're looking at potentially making a modification of a fee for an individual license, it can be it's roughly in anywhere from $11 to the $15. There is one that is higher to even out the. We looked at the cost to do the work, and we decided that the initial operator license and the manager is equal work. The increase is less than the average haircut at a. At a salon that would be your typical chain salon, not a high-end salon. So an average haircut at a chain-type salon is roughly in the $20 range, and the fees are below that. So it isn't, it's a three-year license fee, but it, if you look at it, divided into 3 years.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, they'll get, so these go into effect when 3 years from... when this bill passes, or so there's like a three-year notice for the industry? Or?
Mr. Chair and members, the fees would go into effect on July 1 of this year for the licenses. Please note as well that the fee changes, I don't have it calculated in front of me, the OET, which is now minute surcharge, is going off for the licensees, which that actually will reduce the total increase, because that's roughly 5 or 10% of the license. I can't remember off the top of my head. So those fees are getting stopped this year.
The last question, Mr. Chair, focuses around the rulemaking. You know, Senator Saxog, you know, this is one thing that we hear about, you know, from my perspective, our office here is almost on a weekly basis. You know, that elected officials are kind of held responsible for the rules that are promulgated by state agencies. And quite frankly, we have no effect, none, zero. We don't get to vote on the rules at all. A perfect example is the building code that just went into effect on July 24th, which is adding somewhere, you had the new code changes plus the energy code changes. It's adding about $8,000 to $10,000 to the cost of a new house for any permit pulled after January 24th. And so, you know, those rules keep people out of houses. And so, you know, I'm concerned that giving rulemaking authority, you know, to another state agency without the legislature getting a chance to look at those rules and approve them before they go into effect is just going to put another industry in Minnesota in a situation where it's going to become harder to get into that industry. It's going to be harder to deliver that service and quite frankly, going to raise the cost, again, significantly for those services. Do you have any concern about giving rulemaking authority to another state agencies without elected officials having any oversight over those rules?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I guess I think in terms of efficiency and ultimately you still have the legislature still has the say so. We can change rules or rulemaking ability at any time.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually Senator Saxog, I just thought of another one that's current. Do you represent Detroit Lakes actually?
I know.
You're just, oh, he doesn't? Okay. who represents? Okay. Well, I just this week I heard of another issue. You know, the DNR sent a letter to the city council at Detroit Lakes threatening to sue them and threatening to sue a developer, which is from St. Cloud, due to a development going on the shore of the lake up there. And it's because of the DNR is taking the stand because of the shoreland rules that the DNR promulgated on their own with no approval. From the state legislature, you know, and here now the DNR is sending a letter basically threatening to sue a city and their city council and then a developer that is significantly improving a site because of rules that were promulgated by a state agency. You know, we can argue whether we support certain rules or not, but we're giving up authority as a state legislature every time we give a state agency to promulgate rules without them having to come back for approval before before they go into effect is my concern. So it doesn't appear, you know, you have a concern with the Board of Cosmetology, but I wanted to take this opportunity to express that. So,
thank you, Senator Peterson.
Other questions, Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question. I'm not sure this was covered when Senator Peterson was talking about the parking. Is there going to be a separate rate for surface parking, or will we still have surface parking after the new parking ramp is built?
Mr. Wozlowski, I bet you should stay close by.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Mr. Wozlowski,
did
you hear my question?
Senator Pappas, I did. So there will still be surface parking lots on the campus. And so, for example, Lot Q, which is at the corner of Sherburn and Cedar, will still be there. So there will be and Lot AA across from Rice and University. So those there will be surface lots on the campus and still.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wozlowski, will they have a separate rate then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, they will.
And it will be lower than the ramp, similar to what they are now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, that ratio that you have now between will be, that will stay roughly the same.
Clever. Senator Peterson.
So Mr. Chair and Senator Sacksog, so using that scenario, if all the senators choose to take the surface parking lot, leaving just ramp spots for our staff, is that a scenario, you know, at a higher rate? Is that based on the spots we have available, is that a scenario that could happen? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I'd have to look to see if there's waiting lists on for the surface parking lots. See how many spots would be available. But overall, the demand with the parking on the campus, keep in mind that one of the objectives of the there's a couple of key objectives with the new parking associated with the Senate building. One was the parking from the front of the Capitol off of Aurora Avenue. So there are no longer those parking on Aurora Avenue in front of the Capitol. It is also to provide 20 public ADA stalls. So that's included within that parking facility. So overall, the count on the campus after with the new ramps is approximately the same as it was before. Keep in mind that the Lot B, where the Senate building was, used to be a surface parking lot. So you netted out approximately the same number of stalls on the campus as was existing previously. And overall, you know, certainly during legislative sessions, the parking has been close to at capacity on the campus.
Thank you.
Senator Winstrom.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Similar question. How many new parking spots are in the underground parking at the Senate office building? And it sounds like it's an offset by taking away the Aurora Avenue parking in front of the Capitol.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, so you had it's 264 stalls total with associated with the Senate building project. There's and 20 of those stalls is for public ADA stalls. So, and you're correct. You're removing both the parking that was on Aurora in front of the Capitol, as well as the surface lots that were previously located on Lot B, which is the site for the new building.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the Aurora parking, is there a reason that has to get removed? Is there something going to be built there, or could that still be a space that we would choose to continue using like has been for decades?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, it is certainly a policy decision to make, but it's certainly been a long-term vision for many, including the Cap Board, as well as many others, to remove that parking from the front of the Capitol. So certainly is a policy decision, but it's been part of the long-term vision has been to the extent possible, both for
aesthetic reasons as well as for security reasons to remove parking from front of the Capitol.
Mr. Chair, the 264 spots, so if I understand, the public only for the ADA would get 20. Would the public get access to more of them if they don't sell out at the rate we're talking, or who would all have access to parking under the Senate office building?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, currently that parking is allocated to the Senate. If the Senate elected not to use all of the parking, certainly it would be our responsibility to look to see if there was other individuals or that would be interested in leasing parking stalls at the facility.
And Mr. Chair, what generally, what's the price tag of this new parking ramp that we're trying to cover the cost for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, the cost of the parking facility is about $13.6 million. Was the
okay. Thank you.
Other questions from members? Okay. Are there any amendments? Okay. Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A22 amendment.
Okay, if we could have that distributed. Distributed, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, what this amendment is trying to do is to avoid a significant cost overrun. And what the amendment is requiring the House to do is to vacate the House by June 1 of 2015. The reason being is that if they do not, and they try to maintain the their chamber during the 2016 legislative session, it's going to cost us at least $500,000 more than if they would vacate it and allow the construction to go on and be completed. Some of those cost overruns are, well, some of the problems would be that there would only be temporary toilets. There will be no operating restrooms or running water during the 2016 session. The construction would have to put back the temporary walls to separate construction zones from other zones. The temporary, they would also have to put up temporary signage so that the public safety would be involved. There would be a significant amount of overtime to perform the house renovation between June of 15 and January of 16. I believe none of the they would have only temporary mechanical and temporary electrical provisions, and they would have to reassemble a scaffolding in the house chamber to accommodate the work that's going to be done on the fine arts. So all of that adds up to about $500,000, and that does not count, I believe, the last item, which was the reassembling the cost of the scaffolding. So it seemed to me, as chair of the Capital Investment Committee, that this amendment would be a very wise way to allow the construction to get done quicker and cheaper. And that's why I offer it.
All right, so we have Senator Stump's amendment in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, as much as I enjoy tweaking the House a little bit, the House has to decide what the House is going to do. I understand, you know, that there's all kinds of issues with construction, but I think that just makes the point that maybe this should have been thought through before we started this whole thing. We didn't make plans. We're moving people around, having to rent. It's been kind of a mess to begin with, and I think in general the House has got to decide what the House has to do, and we shouldn't be, you know, telling them what to do and taking away money out of the bill if they don't do what we say, because I think in the end we should have thought this through before we did this thing.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps a better solution would be that the House and Senate don't have session at all next year. Sure. We wouldn't have to worry about it.
Senator Miller said with a very hopeful look on his face.
It was a very hopeful look, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the amendment? Senator Miller. Okay. All right. We've got Senator Stump's amendment in front of us. There's no further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Further amendments?
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Well, I guess related to that discussion, it's puzzled myself and several of us. Senator Stump, maybe you could help lead the charge on this. Why we wouldn't, in a controlled environment for most of the work like we've got here, why we wouldn't push the construction schedule to double shifts instead of maybe the structure that we're seeing going on now, especially once we get out of session. Next year's a short session year. It's not unheard of for the legislature to come back in March, giving them 8, 9, maybe even 10 months to do construction. And so, Senator Stump, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to help with that kind of a plan as well to save money. I can whip up an amendment here. I've got one that we'll try to work on.
Senator Westrom, maybe the question, unless Senator Stump, if you have an answer, might be directed to Mr. Wozlowski. But
yes. I think the Department of Administration would be the.
Yeah, I encouraged him, Mr. Wozlowski, I considered you not to sit in the back.
Mr. Chair, Senators, the construction schedule, first of all, related to the House chambers, our current restoration project plan has the House chambers becoming available again as of March 1st of 2016. It would accommodate a March 1st through May 18th, May 17th legislative session. To do that, it is critical. There's a couple of critical things. There's a lot of work that has to happen in the Senate or House chambers. It involves May 19th. We are scheduled to begin removing, disconnecting the electrical and data from the House desks, and we'd immediately been removing them out of the House chambers. If you've seen some of the photos of the scaffolding that's involved with the rotunda, it's a very similar thing that happens with the House chambers. We will go in and immediately install the scaffolding up in the House chambers. It's important to note also that we are putting in new emergency life safety stairs that are in the northwest corner off the north wing. So there's a significant amount of structural work that has to happen associated with the restoration work. That's already going to involve doing overtime to just get the chambers back completed between June 1st of 2015 and March 1st of 2016. Chair Stump is certainly correct that We've had the construction manager estimate what would be what's the cost impact to that could be avoided if we didn't have to go through all that to get the House chambers ready and available as of March 1st of 2016, and that was estimated at $500,000. We can't stress enough what that is going to be like in the Capitol. The rest of the building is going to be under construction. There's going to be approximately, we'll be at a peak of construction load. We'll have about 300 construction workers throughout the building working during this time. The gallery, for example, on the third floor in the house will not be available. So the plumbing is going to be, the restrooms are going to be the situation that we have now where we have temporary restrooms out in the by the Port Cochere. There won't be indoor restrooms. That's all we have in the current plan to facilitate the restoration project. We can accommodate the House chambers in the Capitol in the 2016 session. There's a lot that has to happen to make that work for everyone.
And Mr. Chair, while you're at the table, what is the cost of the Senate to set up temporary chambers? There must be a cost to that too. What does that cost comparatively?
Mr. Chair, Senator Restrom, we don't have a separate cost estimate with that. That was just part of the building project. We had, with the new Senate building, we had planned to have the temporary chambers installed. You are correct. There is certainly costs associated with getting the right audio capabilities, the voting capabilities, data connections that are needed. I don't have a separate cost for that, but that was part of the overall project funding and plan.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the desks will be moved and there will be a voting board set up and things like that. Seems to me it's not going to take long to get into the six-digit costs of doing that up. Would it be reasonable to think it's going to be in the hundreds of thousands, at least to set up, even though it's built into the cost of the building? Is that an accurate or a logical estimate?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd really have to go back and look at that more. The one advantage, obviously, it's happening while we're doing construction. It isn't like we're going into an existing space and hiring a new design team and contractor to do it. It was part of the plan to begin with, so there were some efficiencies associated with that. But you're itemizing the right items that you have to.
And then when it's done, Mr. Chair, will they just leave it like that and it'll just be a room that's configured the way it is, or will there be cost to change it back to more of a public meeting room or committee room or other office space, or what's the plan after that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Restrom, it is set up to be a hearing room long term. So obviously that has many advantages to setting up the chambers. There's a lot of things that you have in a hearing room that you also need in the chambers, so it isn't a complete redo of the space, but it certainly is. Obviously, you're taking out the desks and you're putting in audience seating. You're putting in a hearing room table that's different than the rostrum you'll have in place with the temporary chambers. So there's a number of differences, but for example, acoustics, the broadcast systems, those broadcast TV systems, the audio system, there's a lot of things, infrastructure that's associated with the hearing room that's going to be utilized for the temporary chambers as well.
But if I hear you right, Mr. Chair, there sounds like there will be some cost to convert it back to the hearing room audience seating and things like that won't get put in now, if I heard you right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, there's certainly costs associated with, obviously you have, sure, and it's part of the project, but you're coming in with all the seating. That's a 150 person seating capacity in that hearing room, so you're coming in with all that seating. You're coming in with the hearing table, staff tables, that type of thing. So there are certainly.
And Mr. Chair, while we're on this topic, you talked about working overtime, and I guess my concept discussing with Senator Stumpf isn't that we pay overtime, it's that you've got 24 hours in a day, you've got a controlled environment, you've got what business does is double shifts, sometimes triple shifts, in 8-hour shifts, 6 a.m. to 2 or 3 and 3 to 11. And are we doing that? Is that what you're referring to as overtime, or are you referring to overtime as sometimes extra long days or Fridays and Saturdays? Can you clarify that? Are we doing double shifts already all the way through from May 19th and on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, a couple of things for that. I mean, obviously, the construction manager, we allow them to sequence. It's a means and methods on how they sequence their work, so they make that decision on how to you know, we give them the dates they have to meet, and they work with their subcontractors to sequence the work and figure out how they're going to get it done. One thing I would note with capital restoration is you have many specialty trades that are involved. It isn't, and there's obviously we're in a very tight construction market in the Twin Cities right now, so it isn't easy to find the labor, with, especially on some of the specialty trades. For example, the decorative painting is a specialty trade that's involved here. With the Capitol building, and you know, speeding up one of the trades, you really have to look at all the trades that are involved in the work on a project, a historic renovation of a building like this, and the capacity that you have in the market to do double shifts. It just is not a looking at other states when they restored their capitals, they had the same thing where they weren't doing double shifts to get the work done.
So, Mr. Chair, what I'm hearing is we aren't doing double shifts. There might be a little overtime from time to time in the sense of somebody putting in over 40 hours a week. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, I think the real point here is that Senate office building is bid out. You know, was part of the bid was that when you were going to have each part of that building done, And that was all part of the contract. Our problem with the house is we've never been able to get a straight answer out of them about when they're going to get out so that we can do the necessary renovation in here, and that's been a real problem. And you can't expect a contractor to without knowing that to give you some type of without at least some additional costs. But back to the Senate office building, that was bid in a certain way, and I'm just assuming, Mr. Woloski, that contractor's on time and at least over there and getting it done.
Mr. Chair, the project's on time and on budget.
Senator Fishbot.
Mr. Chair, I'm not done.
Well, I'm sorry, Senator Westrum.
Senator Saxhawk, you shifted back to the Senate office building. I was talking about the Capitol restoration, but maybe it's analogous, and that probably is on time, on budget. But what we've just heard is we're doing one shift, and a lot of it's we tell them the timeline, and they'll react accordingly. And the idea that we can't bring in a double shift. Now, if you're talking road construction, it's harder because you got rain and you got winter cold climates that come in the fall. We're talking a capital that a large part of it is interior work that you aren't going to have mosquitoes, you aren't going to have bugs. You can work. You've got lighting. You've got things that you can't control when you're out in the weather and the elements. And so it baffles me and several of us senators that we've talked around why we're not doing a more expedited budget when we've got flexibility in next year's legislative session, that we just don't rush it to get it done rather than continue it on for 2-3 years. If some specialty paintings aren't done and they're hard to find, we can operate here without specialty paintings if that is part of the problem.
Mr. Woloski.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I just want to be clear. There is overtime that's included in the capital restoration projects. You are talking about over close to 40 different trade contractors that are involved in a project like this. And so you're sequencing between a mechanical, electrical, plumbing, all the different trades that are involved in a comprehensive restoration like this. So it isn't, you know, it isn't just about getting electricians out in the field on a, for a certain period of time. It's the sequencing of all those different trades on a comprehensive restoration like this. And just to be clear, there is overtime that's
so
the contractor is utilizing on the restoration project.
Mr. Chair, I believe we've got capable contractors, and if we would tell them this is what we wanted, sounds like somebody didn't plan maybe earlier on that rushed some things through. But let me ask you right now, what is happening on Fridays here? Because when I have been here on Fridays during session, there is a noticeable less construction going on in the basement, or do they all shift to some other area of the Capitol during this session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, a lot of the work that's happening as we speak is both in the basement, but it's also in the shafts.
Mr. Chairman, could the testifier please speak into the microphone?
Oh, yep.
So I can't hear him.
Senator. The currently in the east wing, there's a lot of the work is in the shafts. So they're taking the mechanical systems that are being installed in the basement, and they're bringing those systems up vertically through the building, which is a significant challenge in a historic structure like this, like the Capitol. So a lot of the work is, and matter of fact, some of the noises you heard earlier this morning are the shafts that are around the support, the rotunda.
Mr. Chair, just not to drag it up, I specifically asked Fridays. Is there as much work going on Fridays now as there is Monday through Thursday? Because what I've noticed when I've been here is like it is not happening, or else the work is shifting elsewhere. Just that's all I need, a simple answer. Or Friday's not as much being done as Mondays through Thursdays.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that's, again, a means and methods things with the construction team and how they're scheduling the work. I can say their standard shift is they start around 6 o'clock in the morning and they're finishing around 3:30 during the day. That is the standard shift.
Every day.
Every day, whether on a Friday that shift ends earlier, I'd have to check with the construction manager on that.
All right. Thanks.
Sarah Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to request, if we could, some kind of estimate about what it does cost to ready that room in the other. I understand that it's part of the bid, but I think that it wouldn't be that difficult to come up with some kind of an estimate on what it costs us to move over there and then move back. I would make that request.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fishbach, we can certainly provide that.
Thank you.
Okay, members, apparently we have gotten instruction to stop the committee. And we're under call, so I think what we're going to do, I think the schedule is getting a little bit confused, so just stay tuned.
Well, Mr. Chair, are there more? I mean to interrupt, but are there more? How quickly do we need to be up there? Are there more amendments?
I have an amendment. I don't know if there are other amendments. I hope it's a quick amendment. I could offer that and see what happens.
If Mr. Chair is going to be quick, you want me to chair while you handle that?
Oh.
I'm just making the offer to move things along there.
I wish I thought up before I was going to ask Senator Stumpf to chair them.
Roll call.
Okay, if, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
If I could have distributed the A-13 amendment.
A-13 amendment. Would you like to start explaining?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as this is being distributed, if it appears it's a quick amendment, we can proceed with it. Otherwise, then we'd have to adjourn or recess. But I'll wait till it's been. Members at one of the table are saying they don't care to see the amendment. Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
What the amendment does is it allows the transfer of the $250 million to the budget reserve that was part of the proposed Senate budget targets. And simple as that, that in issuing targets for the divisions and the Senate, what we had discussed was an interest on the part of a number of people to add money to the budget reserve. Senator Scoy and I, before last year's session, discussed trying to put money away into the budget reserve. As members might recall, the Budget Trends Commission, chaired by Jay Kudrowski and Kevin Goodnow, several years ago made a strong recommendation, and backed by the Council of Economic Advisors, that the budget reserve should be at 5% of the general fund expenditures. That would suggest if you took the reserve plus the cash flow account, you should have an amount of approximately $2 billion. This would not take it to that level, but would take it to a level of approximately, I believe, $1.7 billion. So we're getting close to that optimum figure that the rating agencies would look at, that the Budget Trends Commission recommended. I think there is certainly popular support for trying to provide an appropriate budget reserve given the size of the budget. So, Mr. Chairman, would move the amendment.
Senator Cohen moves the A13 amendment. Any questions that members have? Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, where does this come from? I'm trying to – says we're transferring it. But where and how does that affect the targets? I guess since you're putting it in this bill, if you could maybe explain the technicality, or possibly Mr. Nauman could.
Senator Cohen.
I'll ask Mr. Nauman can.
Mr. Nauman. Chair and Senator Fischbach, essentially what this amendment would do, if approved by the committee, would be to increase the budget reserve by $250 million. That money would come out of the projected positive budgetary balance from the February forecast. It was a provision that was part of the Senate's target allocation, so this would be in addition to the target. In other words, there's $250 million that was set aside in the Senate targets. Doesn't mean the committee has to do it, but it just means that it was part of the target, but not part of this bill's target.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Cohen
would move the amendment.
Okay, Senator Cohen moves the A13 amendment. Any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Okay.
So
thank you, Senator Stump. Are there other amendments? If there are no other amendments, Senator Saxog.
No, if not, Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate File 888 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
And Senator Saxog, as part of your motion, you would include allowing the staff to make any appropriate technical changes?
I would, Mr. Chair.
All right.
And if did I say as amended? Yeah, I did.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. So, on the Senator Fischbach.
May I ask for a roll call on me?
Okay. Senator Fischbach has asked for a roll call on Senator Saxog's motion. If the clerk is ready, if the clerk would take the roll.
Chair Cohen.
Yes.
Anderson.
No.
Bonoff.
Yes.
Champion. Dibble.
Yes.
Fischbach.
No.
Goodwin.
Yes.
Ingebrigtsen. Latz.
Yes.
Limmer.
No.
Lori.
Yes.
Miller.
No.
Newman.
No.
You know, Pappas.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Saxog.
Yes.
Sieben.
Yes.
Stump.
Yes.
Tomasoni.
Yes.
Westrom.
No.
Uyghur.
Yes.
Champion. Ingebrigtsen. Nino.
Okay, on a motion, on a vote of 12 to 7, the motion carries. So, members, if you can, as I started to say, if you can stay tuned relative to scheduling, we're running into a couple of bumps in the road, but we'll be working on that during the next couple of hours and let everybody know. You probably should expect that we'll meet tomorrow morning. But for now, Senator Westrom.
Can I clarify? Today we are adjourning.
We're adjourning for the day today.
Tomorrow morning is still uncertain.
Likely. We're going to meet tomorrow probably in the morning and into the afternoon is my guess.
Okay, so we will meet in the morning at 8:30.
No.
As far as I know.
No,
okay.
No.
But we'll get back to people quickly.
Right. No. So did you point in the